If it's only one, I'm in good shape.
Doesn't really make much of a difference. The question that I wanted to ask is that, I'm sorry, thank you. Very, very often, the 50-50 arrangement encourages joint parenting. Even though there could be joint legal custody, if the living arrangement is very much in by one parent, the other parent becomes uncle, dad, or aunt, mom.
I think everyone heard the question, so I don't need to repeat it. That can happen in a 50-50 arrangement. That can happen in an every other weekend arrangement. What's the key factor here is the ability for both parents to be actively involved in the life of the child. It's to maximize the time that a child has with a parent. And if that works for the parents to be a 50-50, wonderful. If that works for the parents to be an every other weekend, wonderful. I've had situations where parents are fighting and arguing, I need 50-50, and father is a Washington lawyer who leaves at 6 in the morning and comes home at 10 at night, hires two nannies to raise his children, but he wants 50-50. Well, if he's a powerful enough lawyer in the Washington area, he's probably going to end up with a 50-50 arrangement, but what's the impact of that on the life of the child? Is the child's time with a parent maximized? I will stick by my argument that the specifics of the living arrangement does not impact the life of the child, whether parents argue about that relationship, whether or not the parents are both seen by the child as active participants in the life of the child, are the critical factors. Not, I need 50-50, or I need 60-40, or I need whatever the guidelines are in each state so that I can avoid certain levels of child support payment. A whole nother story. Please.
In the thing that I asked and I heard, I agree with you when both parents are working together, it's not really relevant. But more often than not, especially when you're dealing with religious couples, more often than not, there's ongoing arguments and strife and so on and so forth, because the reason why I stress this by religious couples, because if religious couples could work it out, most of the time they'll stay together. However, when there is not, so I agree with you, and it's the best health of the children to be working together no matter what the living arrangement is. But if that ideal situation does not exist, wouldn't you say that more, it doesn't have to be exactly 50-50, but closer to that arrangement ensures that the child will build a relationship with both parents?
I don't agree with that. I believe that it's incumbent on the parents after the separation and divorce to work on developing now a very different kind of relationship with their child and a different kind of relationship with their ex. And I'm not going to argue that any amount of physical time by itself is going to allow that relationship. Clearly, you need sufficient amount of time to have that relationship with the child. But what the specifics of that specific amount of time is irrelevant in the growth of the child. It may be important for the parent. It's not important for the child. There's a question back there, please.
So sometimes I wonder if I should or shouldn't lie about what's going on. For example, let's say my daughter will want to go to a specific high school and my ex-husband will want something else. And the school he wants is completely off the radar as to something that she would be good for her. So he'll say to her something like, well, I know that I can't trust you in, let's say, this particular flapper school, because I know that you can get involved with boys and all kinds of bad things can happen, and meaning he's berating her. So the question is, do I tell her something like, well, you know something, we're going to discuss it, and Tati really cares about you, and really I think no, this guy has Asperger's syndrome, and I think I know I cannot discuss it with him. I'm going to have to deal with the arbitrator. So I'm not sure what the right thing to do is. And she's almost 14, and she's astute and intelligent, et cetera.
One thing I see is, and I assume everyone's hearing the questions. I don't need to repeat them. One of the things that divorce does is it breaks trust in the child. There's trust in children from the very early years that my parents will be there for me. It allows the toddler to take her first steps. It allows the child to go to preschool and kindergarten because there's a trust that no matter what, my parents will be there for me. Divorce shatters that trust. Trust becomes important then in the communication that a parent has with a child post-separation. That child will be looking for other instances where the parent is not being truthful. I can't trust you again. You said mom and dad will always be there together for me always. You weren't. Now how can I believe you when you say something else? So the reason I raise that is because you asked the question, use the word, do I lie to my child? And my answer is no. I believe a co-parenting relationship really has to be based on a level of honesty to the child and truthfulness. That doesn't mean the whole truth as you perceive it. Your truth is not necessarily your ex's truth, and it's not necessarily the truth of the world. It is your perception of the truth. But what you say to your child should be truthful. Bubba Mises, in this case, come back to haunt you later, because that child is looking for instances where you also are breaking that level of trust. If you could divorce mom or dad, can you divorce me also? Oh, Tatala, of course not. We would never do that. But isn't that what you said to mom and dad as well? So the child is looking for other instances of breaking of the trust. So I believe that what you say to that child has to be the truth. Not the whole truth, and rarely the whole truth in divorce situations, but what you say has to be truthful. Another question, second row, please.
Hi, being that you were saying that it's very important for kids to have relationships with both parents, the kids that live with me, half of my kids are with me and half are with my ex. The kids that live with me have a very good relationship with both parents. I'm a very firm believer in that. The kids that live with my ex, one who communicates with me on the phone only when he's in the dormitory, because he says he's not allowed to call when he's home. The other one I haven't seen or spoken to for about a year and a half. I met him once on the street. He turned his back to me and spit. What could I do to show him that I still care? I send him notes. I hear he rips them up. I call his Rosh Hashiva to find out how he's doing, and right now I don't even know where he is in school.
It's a shame when those happen. And
so what could I do to, in any positive way, to let him know I still care?
Well, unfortunately, it's one of those horrible events, and what one does is one maintains the contact even if you're not hearing back. There's an interesting study, and I'll answer your question more directly in a second. It's from one of the Scandinavian countries, and it followed youth who had been alienated from a particular parent, and it tracked them into their young adulthood. And there are two significant findings to this study. These are kids who, as teenagers, turned away from one parent and had no contact with that parent after separation and divorce. Two significant findings. Finding number one, over half of the youth said they wish someone would have forced them to have a relationship with the rejected parent, that they wish someone would not have said to them, go ahead, do what you want to do. And number two, the most astounding thing for me, is that nearly half of the kids in adulthood had no relationship with the former favored parent and now had a relationship with what had been the rejected parent. Let me repeat that. A little under half of the kids, as young adults, who had rejected a parent in their adult life, had flipped, and now rejected the parent who had been the favored parent and had a relationship with the parent who was rejected. So what does one do? Well, clearly the first part of the study says there has to be some element of force placed on so that the child does not have the power or the ability to reject a parent. And two, the ability of that parent to maintain in whatever capacity possible a linkage to that child. in the hope that later on the relationship with that child can be developed as an adult-adult relationship. It does happen, and it happens more often than one thinks. Please, standing. If you want to just say it, and I'll repeat it. He needs the mic.
I have three children I didn't see for 4 years. And the question is, in order to prevent sickness, you have to find what the solution. Problem is, we have a lot of people, it's all about money. Alienation come for supervised visitation from lawyers like Steven Z. Mostovsky, who become a judge. He's a most corrupt.
Okay, I don't think we are going to entertain names.
I have a question. My question
Please.
Is, how I could show...
And I have no relationship. I'm from Washington, D.C., so I just...
It's fine, but the question is, how I could show my children attention, how I could contact them. You're talking about she holding my children, the whole system, the whole corrupt system, including rabbis. So how could I go and show my children that I'm for you?
Well, I recall that a case that I worked with where there was some allegations made against the parent and all the contact was supervised with that parent. And for a period of time, they were having therapy sessions in my office. And I lovingly watched this father who for 1 hour every other week was having contact with this 8-9-year-old girl, and it had to be in my office. And I watched this father over time lovingly learn how to make that hour precious. I need to tell you, when the girl was 13, it was a very different living arrangement. It was a very different relationship that that parent had with that child. And in part because that parent worked to make whatever contact was legally allowed into the most meaningful contact that parent can have with that child. I can't speak to personal issues, obviously, but the time that one has with the child, for whatever the reasons that may be, can still work toward maintaining a meaningful relationship with that child. And that's what we have to work for. Please.
So I have a question for you. What happens if the parents are not alienating, one parent is not alienating the other parent from the other parent, and the children still do not want to go to the other parent? What do you do in that aspect?
Well, usually...
I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, you're not putting me on the spot. I teach. I'm used to it. There are usually three factors that go on in a reunification problem, and that's a reunification issue, that a child refusing to have contact with a parent, and I'll just talk in general terms. There are usually three things of different weight in each family. One, we generally have a rejected parent who has some kind of an issue, an emotional kind of an issue. Often it's anger, often it's a perception of anger, but we often have a parent with a problem. Two, we often have one enmeshed parent. That's not quite the same as alienation. That's a parent who believes that, Bubala, I have to take care of you. I have to make sure you're okay. We have to make sure you're fine, and doesn't let that child grow and develop and experience her own experiences. And then three, we have a vulnerable child. We have, for whatever reason, a child who has issues or factors in her life that make her influenced more easily by the war between the parents. To change so that there is reunification of the contact between the parent and the child, all three of these players, to different degrees, need to change. If there's an angry parent, that has to change. If there's an enmeshed parent, that has to change. And if there's a fragile child, that child needs to get help, so that changes also. Let me go to the two other questions.
My question
okay, someone
still
in the back. Someone in the back has been waiting.
My question still wasn't answered, but what do you do to comfort this child if they still don't want to go to the parent?
Parents make decisions about that, not children.
You encourage that child to go, and the child still doesn't want to go, and you say, this is still your parent, and it would be, you know, they want to see you grow, they want to see Shabbosim Yantoivim. You know, it's a very hard decision.
Often Often it requires both parents sending a clear and consistent message to the child, standing in the back, it's the microphone, person standing in the back. To try to more fully answer your question, and then we need to move on, the first demand is that both parents send a message to the child that it is important for the child to have contact and a relationship with both parents. I view it, what would you do if the child says, I don't want to go to school tomorrow? You would say, you're going to school tomorrow.
That's your job.
And it's also your job to have a relationship with both parents. It's not a choice item. Question in the back.
Thank you. I just want to let you know that I happen to agree with everything you said.
Everything?
Except for one area. But
would you like to tell my children that?
And your wife. I do agree with what you said. I agree with the visitation. As long as the parents get together, I see it, I believe it. And I loved your analogy with the business partner. However, the practicality of it, and there's one flaw that I think is a little missing. The flaw that I see is that, yes, it's a business partner that we have to have. But did your partner of 30 years lie to you on a consistent basis? Did that partner sell your trade secrets away? Did that partner sell your trade secrets to your best friend? Did they lie to you over and over and go to therapy, steal from you? Ironically enough, the first question brought up by a lady, are you allowed to lie? Case in point. The partner is lying to you and betraying you.
I'm sorry, if you could ask your question and then we need to move on.
So the practicality of it is nice that you said,
work
like a partner. I guess I have to buy your book, How Do You Work With That Partner? But this isn't a partner of 30 years that you, like you said, don't like. This is a partner who has betrayed you over and over again. How do you, this is the question I guess, work with that person who has constantly betrayed you on the most deepest and intimate levels?
I start with basic question and basic belief.
Nice.
My basic belief in working with families of divorce is that both parents share one interest, the child. If the parents do not share that one interest in the health and growth and development of the child, it's not going to work. That's the only 2x4 that I have in my toolkit. It's the only thing that I can do to hit people over the head with, is say, if you truly love and care for your child, the anger, the rancor, the hostility that you've had has to go away. All the other difficulties that go on in divorce, fight it out financially, do whatever you want to do. But if you want to raise a healthy child, this is what you have to do. Does it always work? No. Is it what we aim for? Absolutely. And there's one more question, please.
So my question built on that is really...
Oh, I was hoping you'd have a different kind of question, please.
Well, the question is, you know, let's say you're putting a business together, right? You have to get people to the table and you have to negotiate. So really, from getting to the point where we all want the best for our child, there's this practical reality that we have had a contentious relationship. And so how do we make that jump? Who helps, you know... Really
you want me to tell you who really helps?
How do you get there? Like, we all want to get there. So what do we do now?
I'll tell you what really helps. It's called the identified patient in this. And the identified patient is the child. I started off by saying we see it in the suffering of the child. We see it in the pediatrician's office. We see it on the ball fields. We see it in the hurt in our children. And what happens in these cases is the child hurts. And through the pain of the child, you know, it's like any other doctor. You do a diagnosis. What's the problem here? Is it really that the child has belly aches and won't go to school? Or is it the child seeing the parents at war and we have to treat it from that way? So it's really through the pain of the child that these families have to come together.
How?
They end up in the pediatrician's office.
We need someone who's actually going to, you know, be the mediator for this process.
Often,
we can't do it together.
Often, yes, and
it's
called parent coordination.
Okay.
It's a process that occurs. Let me just close, and I was told that we have another wonderful speaker to go on tonight, and I want to say thank you very much. I find your questions very insightful, and b'hatzlacha.